Well, hey there, Scott.
Hey, what's up, man?
It is good to see you again. I've been gone for a couple weeks now, and Lulu and I went on vacation, so we had a little road trip across country in the middle of summer.
Yeah, super fun.
Yeah,
right. Fighting all the other traveling families.
3 stars, not recommended.
Yeah, fair.
But probably a little bit better planning would have gone good. But we had a great time. So, what did you guys do this last couple weeks while?
You know, it's been a rough couple weeks for me. I had to go to the dentist a couple times. I had a tooth that was bugging me. They had to fix it up. So, just been recovering. It's been a rough couple weeks, but we had some good interviews in here too. Catch Wesley and Tucker on the interview portions of things. They are some characters. It was a really fun interviews.
Cool beans.
But yeah, man, just been working away. So kind of a boring couple weeks. Not an exciting vacation. I was just seething in jealousy that I wasn't on vacation as well.
Have you ever used any of the vacation like planning apps or methods or whatever? So I signed up with one that I haven't used yet, which is supposed to be a way to use your credit cards to get points, to then use your points to get better vacations or better flights or hotel stays.
You know, I have like a few thousand bucks on my credit card, like in a rewards thing that I can use for travel, but I have not done it yet. So I probably should look more into that. But I'm kind of like you on the travel thing. I just sort of wing it. We just go somewhere and then
I think I'm about done with winging it, though. This one might have broke me.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, we had a good time. We did have a good time, but there was a lot of it was very time consuming to go from place to place and continually look up hotels and then luggage in and out of the car and stuff like that and everything and there was a couple times when we actually spent a lot of money on a hotel, you know, thinking to ourselves that it would be really nice to be in a little bit nicer spot.
Mm-hmm.
And it just turned out to be average or not that great or even disturbing.
Yeah.
And, of course, we didn't communicate that to the girls, you know, but, you know, if you're spending $500 for a night at a hotel, you know, you expect a little bit more.
A little 4-star, 5-star.
Yeah.
You know,
but we had a good time overall, though. I mean, we did some interesting things. Have you ever been glamping?
You know, I've never been glamping, but I feel like it's the only camping I would do anymore. I was a Boy Scout back in the day, and I've spent a lot of nights roughing it, but, as an adult and particularly a pudgy adult, I like a bed. I can't sleep on the ground anymore.
Well, we found that out there by the Grand Canyon,
mm-hmm.
Surprisingly, we thought it was a lot closer to the Grand Canyon. I guess I should have consulted a map.
Okay.
But it was about 30 minutes or 45 minutes from the Grand Canyon, but mm-hmm. on the same road to the canyon.
Yeah.
We found a spot out there, and they have... They're definitely charging, you know, luxury prices.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically a lot of very sturdy tents.
Yeah.
built up off the ground. You had a little bit of a deck.
Uh-huh.
And some of the tents had like a skylight to them where when you laid in bed, you could see up. I thought that's what we were getting, but we didn't.
Mm.
But it was okay. We spent most of the night kind of hanging out on the porch. They had a really nice community area with bonfires and free s'mores and stuff. And it was a really nice night. We only stayed there one night.
Would you do it again?
I would possibly.
So a very mild recommendation from the
bar. Mild recommendation on that one. Just because I feel like that... I feel like that for the price, it was probably not quite what I was thinking.
Yeah.
But they definitely put a lot of effort, and they were extremely friendly, and it was nice. And it was one of the most beautiful things was just being able to walk outside and look up and see the whole universe, you know, the stars and everything. And I don't think we get enough of that.
Certainly not in the city. No, it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah, but it was a good time. You know, we had a lot of different experiences, and... we got to see some of our friends. We got to take the kids to Disneyland and Lulu to Disneyland. So one of our friends has an annual pass.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
So you get to, like, piggyback off that or something?
To a degree. Yeah. I don't think that we got much of a discount. But what we did get, I think, was reservation spots or something like that. Because they can only let so many people in the park each day.
Right.
And so we got that. And then there were a few. Oh, I know what the other perks were, was that anything that we purchased, we could use her discount rather than.
The last time I went to one of those big amusement parks, it seemed like it was an hour and a half in every line. Just you get to ride like three rides, and that was the day.
That was our experience as well.
Yeah.
And apparently there's a lot of tricks of the trade there. So one of them is to go and ride as a single person, because apparently most people want to go as a group because they're together.
So you kind of slip in.
Right. A lot of them have like these single riders, because what they'll do is they want to make sure that all the seats are filled, right, to capacity. So whenever a group comes in, like let's say that each seat can fit four people and there's seven people in the group, well, then they'll throw in a single rider so that all the cars will be completely filled up.
Fair enough.
Jesse did a couple of those, but the rest of us, we had like two or three rides that we did.
I bet there's like whole websites dedicated to the tricks of the trade amusement parks, right?
Yeah, there absolutely is. Yeah. They used to have a thing where you could buy, you could basically buy your way to the front of the line. So they would have I don't feel great about that one, but I will say this, I can understand why people buy it, you know, who have the money to do it, because of the fact that you're standing in line hot, you know, a really hot line for two hours or more.
Yeah. I wonder if that's like an analogy for how you feel about capitalism right there, whether you're, how long you're willing to stand in line before you spring the money to skip.
Kinda, yeah. And they've also cracked down on people like faking handicaps to get to the head of the line.
You know, I read an article, or maybe I saw a documentary, I can't remember, where you could like rent a handicapped person for the day, and they would take you all over the place in the parks and Disneyland and stuff,
used
skip
to be
all
a
the
thing.
Lines. What a and the thing that just seems like so wrong.
And the thing that they've done now is you can still do that. I don't know if you can rent a handicapped person, but what they've done, I think, to combat that a little bit is they have made it where if you're a handicapped person and you're going to the head of the line to get a ride, because they still offer that, you can only bring one person with you.
Oh, fair enough.
So you can't take like
the whole
group.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Tricks of the trade, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I'm Scott Hess, tax and business consultant.
I'm John Barton, small business owner. Remember the tortoise and the hare? Slow and steady wins the race.
We started Turtle Smith to help people start small businesses, providing information and resources to small business owners and entrepreneurs.
Build a solid foundation and forge your dreams.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this week's episode, we're continuing on with our steps, and we're talking about the next step, which is concept development. And to be honest, there's not a whole lot for us to talk about, but this is probably going to be one of the more time-consuming steps for people doing their plan. So the definition of concept development is just to define and refine a specific idea to bring clarity, coherence, and structure. And the way we suggest doing that is building a training manual. I don't know if you have one for your business. I waited 10 years to start mine, because now that I have employees, I need a training manual. It is awful. I have all the steps in my head, but writing them down and giving them to somebody else is the worst.
You don't know if I have one. Well, my wife has been waiting years for me to write a little information card for our cases.
Yeah.
You know, so,
yeah, fair enough.
So the answer to that is no. But I will say this. My first wife, she worked for a billiard supply company, and she wrote the training manual. She wrote the instruction book for them. She was employee number one. And she wrote a pretty comprehensive book. And interestingly enough, part of the reason why she ended up writing that for them was because early on, one of the employees sent a package to Swaziland instead of Switzerland.
Fair.
So she wrote up a whole thing about, you know, a checklist, more or less, you know, to make sure that addresses were right and so on. And I haven't checked back in years, but you know, as of about 10 years ago or so, they were still using what she wrote.
Fair enough. Well, in this one, you do want to create a bunch of checklists and really a step-by-step guide for yourself. Every kind of process that you have to go through in your company. So everything from accepting payments to paying bills to actually doing the core of your business, you need to write out the process, or we call it a standard operating procedure. And the reason for it, there's a bunch of reasons for it, but the main reason in this case is so you can really see what all you need to accomplish your job and to start your business. So if you go through and you're a t-shirt company and you're sorting t-shirts, you know that you have to have bins for your t-shirts, you have to have a table to sort it, you have to have everything that you need to make the process easier, and that helps with planning, so getting all your startup costs and making sure that you have enough space and that you have all the things and little nitty gritty details that you need to accomplish the job. So one of the examples I'll use is, I don't know if you've ever done a DIY project, at home, and you go to Home Depot and then you get back to the house and you're about a third of the way through and you realize you forgot 7 things. So you got to go back to Home Depot. Then you come back and you get about 2/3 of the way done and you still need 4 more things. So you got to go back another time. It feels like every time I try to do something, I got to go 4 or 5 times to Home Depot to get it done. And if I just would have really taken the time to think about it at the beginning and walked through what all I needed to do, I probably could have saved myself a lot of time. But most people aren't like that. So
yes, we hate the ones that are.
No, they're good businessmen.
We admire the ones that are naturally like that.
Right. And strive to be like them.
Right.
So again, a couple different reasons to do this. The first one is, as you kind of go through all of this, you should be able to create yourself a startup cost list. So you should be able to create kind of an Excel spreadsheet that has every item that you need to accomplish the job from kind of start to finish. And you should also be able to identify some suppliers and vendors and things that you're going to have to work with. You already did a little bit of that in the feasibility study. Now it's time to really narrow down on everything that you're going to need to be buying and trying to sort of get those initial costs. You can always call people, get price lists, quotes, everything that you need. A lot of information is available online. So that's sort of the step-by-step guide. And as the more detailed you can be, the better your plan will be. I know it's boring and time-consuming, but it's important.
So another thing that I would say there that is important, and this is looking forward more to the future when you get your business open and you're going and everything. Mm-hmm. Back in the beginning of my current business, my plan was to have a basic, and we did have this, we had a wall of prototypes.
Mm-hmm.
But not only prototypes, we had a wall of, part of the wall was what we are actually doing. So the current version of the thing, right?
Okay.
So call it the way that a pocket sits, right? So my idea was that this would be, if anybody needed a reference, they would go there and get the current version and see it. But then what we found out is what happens is somebody somewhere will make a small change, and then suddenly all the cases coming off the benches will be done that way.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, I would notice that a change was made, and I would say, who did this? Nobody could say who did it. So we had a little bit of version creep. But the thing is the change that was made was better for the product. It's just that nobody took the time to say, okay, let's make a new version of it, put it up on the wall so that now this is the ideal version. And so I dubbed it, I came up with a term for this. I call it version creep,
you know.
Where things just incrementally change. So what I would say to that is always be open for that, but also plan for it and realize that sometimes, you're going to have an SOP and somebody in your organization will figure out a better way to do something that won't necessarily make it into the SOP, but then everybody will be doing it.
Yeah, standard operating procedures can certainly change over time and your employees can make them better.
Right. So my advice would be as part of the standard operating procedure, you make it so that you make some kind of formal way for the standard operating procedure to change.
It's a great idea. A little bit further on why we're doing this too, the startup costs are important, but you kind of hit on another big point, which is efficiency. And so as you're doing all of these step-by-step guides, you should be able to find holes kind of in your processes and procedures, and you should be able to really tighten up with your workflow and your efficiency. One of the good examples I'll use is, you seen that movie The Founder and the McDonald's brothers, they created the deal? Mm-hmm. Well, there's a scene where they're out on a tennis court with their employees, and they've got like the workflow mapped out on the floor, and they're practice making burgers and making sure that everything's flowing properly from station to station. That's a really important thing to do. I mean, you don't have to go so crazy as to go out on a tennis court and map everything out, but just, you know, draw it out in your head and think about, you know, where things are going to go and how everything's going to operate within your business, particularly, you know, if you have some type of product you're making or storing or, you know, repackaging or whatever.
So we used to do that. I used to do that for shows.
Mm-hmm.
I would actually tape off where the booth was going to be, the size of it and everything, mm-hmm. and then where products were going to be. And we would have not necessarily direct practice run-throughs like that, but a sense of the feel of what the traffic flow would be when someone walks in the booth, and where and how we would process their sale and so on, so that we weren't tripping over each other.
That's great. My brother just started doing the farmer's market stuff, and so I was telling him he should film himself doing it in the backyard. So he put up his whole tent and everything in the backyard, and then got a look at it and made sure he liked everything, and then took it all down and also kind of timed himself for how long it would take.
Listen, that is great advice, because I can't tell you enough that the times that I want to scream at people at farmer's markets
mm-hmm.
about how crappy that they've set up their setup is. And as a veteran of all the shows that I've done, I can see how they set their booths up in such a way where it's not really comfortable for customers.
Right.
And I think that is fantastic advice to game it out, practice it, you know, and get a feel for just like I said, so you're not only are you not tripping over yourself while you're trying to present your product, but you maximize the space that you have so that you can really allow more than one person at a time to interface with your product, so to speak, you know, and you can talk to them.
For sure, and doing it ahead of time is the key.
Absolutely.
Because you think you'll get there, and you'll be like, we'll figure it out once we get there, and we'll get it all set up, and then it just ends up kind of looking like trash. So when you plan ahead for these things, it tends to work a lot better.
Let me tell you about that.
Yeah.
So there's been plenty of times. I told you that there's been a lot of times where I've taped it off and you know, kind of tried to figure out what the booth is going to be. Then there have been other times where I've gone to a show with that mindset of, let's just figure it out on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of those times, the booth has not been done when the show opened. And for the first day and a half or so, you know, or longer sometimes, we have sold out of boxes like we're, you know, the bargain bin at Walmart or something.
Yeah.
And it has never been a good feeling for me to have that. And then I would make jokes about it, and I'd tell everybody, I'd say, hey, the booth will be done by Sunday,
yeah.
you know, and the show started on like Monday, you know, mm-hmm. and when that happens, you've always kind of got that feeling that you're splitting your time between, promoting and selling your product and continually building the booth throughout the show.
Yeah.
So you don't want that, is
no.
what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So at the end of this kind of step-by-step deal, you should really have a training manual that's detailed enough where you could literally hand it to a stranger and they could just go run your business. I don't realistically expect everybody to do that. I encourage everyone to do that, but it is a sort of a tall order. So at the very minimum, make sure that you at least kind of jot down what all you need and how things are going to work and really take a minute to think about how this is all going to work together and how all your products and everything are going to flow together. So the other kind of thing we hit on in concept development is packaging and labels. So if you're selling a physical product, you've done your brand development in the step before, now's the time to kind of look at the actual physical product that people will receive. And it's really important to look at especially if you're mailing things, what is it going to look like when they open the package? I can't tell you how often I've ordered stuff on Amazon or something, seen the picture, and then I get it, and I'm always a little bummed out, which I think happens to everybody. So looking at how it's presented when they get it, and then, yeah, checking your labels, your boxes, everything like that. This is another good time to start getting quotes on packaging and those kind of things. And the last sort of thing we talk about in this concept development too is, especially if you have like a service business, and we talked in the elevator pitch section about the follow-up. So you want to, now you want to look at handouts and your kind of company documents. So putting together a little brochure, what your business cards are going to look like, what kind of documents you want to hand when you're trying to sell somebody. Do you guys give anything out? Like if somebody comes by and they like a case, but they don't like it, or they don't want to buy it right then. I think you had talked about where you hand a card and it used to have like their names on the back and stuff. So, who they talk to.
So yes, I have a card which I call a show card, mm-hmm. Which we also can use if someone comes to the shop. Mm-hmm. But the show card is basically on the front is a business card with all of our information. But on the back, it says model. It says, you know, let's say, so what was I interested in? What was the model? Basically, it's giving them all the information written down on the card, so that when they call back in, they can reference exactly what they were looking at. And then we're not doing shows right now. We don't have plans to continue doing them, but when I was doing them, I would encourage people to also take a picture, and then we would take a picture of whatever it was they were doing with the card.
Gotcha.
So to do that, but even without that, just with the card alone, that proved to be a really good way for customers to remember, because they're being inundated at our shows. They're being inundated with hundreds of new products that they haven't seen. And I wanted to make sure that they had at least a fighting chance to remember what it was they liked about ours.
That's a clever one. And I would encourage anybody who's doing booths or products like that to have something along those lines. Because yeah, you'll forget if you're looking at 300 products in a day, you know. So the handouts and then company documents are really kind of hit and miss. You may not need them, but it's time to think about in your concept development, you know, like what your invoices are going to look like, memos if you have employees and stuff that you're going to have to deal with, and just sort of what the internal documents and the customer facing documents are going to look like. No real reason to design or go way into the weeds, but just making sure that you know what you need and what they're kind of going to look like is important.
I would also add that it's very important, especially these days with the advent of cloud systems, mm-hmm. that you really think about where do these documents live, like what kind of folders are they in, can people get to them quickly if they need to get to them, does everybody know where to get to them, does everybody have the access that they need, and as well. Very important is who's allowed to edit them and who's allowed to just view them, download them, print them, and who's allowed to actually edit them. That is something that I have done on a hit and miss basis. And mm-hmm. I'll give you an example of the miss part. I have a folder called Media Assets, where I have videos, 30-second ads. I have, you know, I thought I had print ads there, but apparently I don't.
Yeah.
And I've created dozens of print ads over the years, but now they're kind of scattered throughout my hard drive, or hard drives plural, you mm-hmm. know, and none of them are on the cloud. So now if I want to access them, I got to start popping in old hard drives to find all those old files. Some of them were good ads that could be continually used.
Right.
So basically I cost myself, you know, a couple extra hours searching for these things. And then I finally, at the end of the day, I had to just sit down and make up a new ad for a tournament coming up that I'm sponsoring. And if you will take the time to figure out a really good logical way to handle all the folders and make sure that it stays that way, that will save you and your employees a ton of time.
Yeah, it's a great idea. You've hit on that a couple times when we've talked about this project especially, and other things that we've worked on is making sure that we have a good place to save things. So I'm glad you brought that up. That's a good point.
Because information gets buried.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've lost documents and stuff before and had to hunt them down, you know, on a, I don't know, a backup drive or in my email or some nonsense just because I didn't save them in the right spot or something like that. So.
And it's very easy to do because it's easy to create stuff. And it just goes to, you know, whatever default folder, you know, that you happen to be working in that day. I found things that are completely unrelated in folders that I thought I saved it in the right space.
Yeah.
But it's like my housing documents, you know, and then I'll have things related to my case business there.
Right.
You know, and right. I'll be like, oh, that's where I stuck it.
Yeah, because you always think to yourself, I'm going to remember it when I save it, and then you never do.
Or you think you'll be able to search for it and get it,
right.
And you don't remember what you called it.
Right, right. Well, any final thoughts on the training manual, standard operating procedures, those kind of things?
Once again, I think it's one of those things that's boring as shit to create, but the excitement, if as much as excitement can be generated, should be thought of as this will make life a hell of a lot easier down the road.
And whatever time you put into this step will certainly save you headache and time in the future and probably save you some money.
And also it identifies things like we talked about. Mm-hmm. Like you just alluded to a minute ago, you said, you know, you'll start to see kind of the holes in your thinking,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and there's a lot of what ifs that happen with creating a standard operating procedure. What
yep.
happens if I do this or whatever, you know, I can tell you as an employer, there's very rarely anything good that happens when you tell an employee to just figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, because yeah. they're it's not their business, you know, and if they're capable of figuring it out and willing to do that, then they're just as capable of starting their own business. And so you have to give them guidance because they don't want to I can tell it as an there was a time between my companies where I was the employee.
Mm-hmm.
And I was hired, you know, because of my entrepreneurship. But when I got there and I realized, you know, that when I took the initiative and started doing things without getting permission, or things that weren't necessarily in the SOP, that one would think an entrepreneur, you know, would just go for it, right? Then I started to clash with the owner of the company, who is a good friend of mine and remains a good friend of mine to this day. But it was basically, you know, two entrepreneurs butting heads on the direction of, you know, the company that one of them didn't own.
Yeah.
And so it made it uncomfortable because he did tell me when he hired me, he said, you know, a lot of the times just he would say that constantly, just do it, just figure it out, right? And then I go to do it, and it's not according to the way that they wanted it done.
Yeah.
So it is very important, I think, to give employees good guidance, but also keep an open mind that they have ideas. And if they come up with a better way to do something, adopt it, incorporate it, and move on.
Fair enough.
This episode is sponsored by JB Cases. JB Cases is a pool cue case company specializing in custom cases. They have been in business since 2007, and their motto is true protection, true durability, true comfort, and true custom. Visit them at jbcases.com.
Well, that kind of segues neatly into our next topic of the day, which is what it's like to have employees. So I think it worked out well.
Well,
excuse me. You have a handful of employees working for you. I now have five employees, I think, working for me. Four? Five. Four and a half. So it's interesting. I never thought I would have employees. I started my business just kind of as a solo person and was thinking, you know, I can kind of take care of everything myself and just work on my own and not have to worry about anything. But it's sure been nice to delegate some of the stuff I don't want to do.
It is very nice when you have people around you that you can count on and that are able to do the work. I have, throughout my career now with the two companies, I will say this, it's something that you really have to sit down and think about and get with somebody qualified. Until I started listening to you on this, I was not doing it the right way. I wasn't like seeking resumes. I was just going through my friends list, and I don't mean Facebook friends. I mean like my local,
And
list.
I
And
think that's very common for small business owners. They need help. They have a buddy who needs some work, and they just hire them on instead of going after and finding the right person for the job.
I will say from experience, and please, no offense to anybody that watches this in the future that knows me, that has worked for me, that is generally a bad way. Because if the work isn't being done the way you want, then you face the issue of how do I tell my friend, that he's not doing it the right way.
Well, so one of my key rules for hiring is never hire anybody that you feel uncomfortable or can't fire, unless they're your partner, like an actual business partner or life partner or whatever. You can't hire somebody that you can't fire. It sucks. You can't hire friends or anything like that, because then you ruin the friendship.
Yeah, and then the other thing that I've kind of found out is I honestly don't even like to hire people for other jobs to do other work for me who are in my friends' circle. For the same similar reason, right? If they don't do a good job, then now I've got to wonder about how it's going to affect my friendship.
Or you just have to pay for the job to get done over again.
Yeah, and not say anything,
Right.
and that has happened to me. All of those things have happened. But what I will do, almost religiously, if I like them, even if I don't necessarily know firsthand that their work is first rate, I will at least recommend them. If somebody casts about and says, "Is somebody, do you know anybody who does driveways or something like that?" Then I will recommend my friends, but I personally, nowadays, tend to shy away from hiring them just so I can make sure that I preserve the friendship. So my point there is, and I'm not saying don't hire your friends, right? Because there's a meme going around that's like, if your friend is in business, give him the business, and so on. So I like that sentiment. But what I'm just saying is, if it's a critical thing, and you're hiring somebody only because they're your friend, then you ought to know that they're capable of doing a really good job, so that you don't impact your friendship, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And the same thing goes for employees.
Fair enough. One of the things I kind of wanted to talk about and was a tough realization for me when I hired my first couple of employees is it's just to be realistic. We use that word a lot, realistic, but in this case, be realistic about your expectations of what they're capable of and what they'll do for you. Because the bottom line is, if you hire somebody to work for you and your business, they don't care as much as you do. Doesn't matter what you do. It's your business. It's your baby. You have a passion for this. This is everything to you. The people you hire do not feel the same way. They're not going to put in the extra hours for free and be excited about coming in on the weekend to finish a big project. They have lives. Most of them just want to work 9 to 5 and go home. That's a fine thing to do. But you, as the employer, probably have a little bit more drive and entrepreneurial spirit, and you want to build something bigger. Other people, they just are looking for a paycheck. And it's okay to hire people that just want a paycheck. So you shouldn't expect, the moon and stars from them. So realistic expectations when you hire employees is really important.
Yeah, and again, that goes back to the whole interview process and weeding out, just allowing yourself the opportunity to see a bunch of candidates, talk to them, get a feel for what they're thinking, see people with different qualifications and different backgrounds, and realizing that, it's not always the best candidate on paper. Like the person who has the most qualifications might not be the best fit for your business. You could end up with someone who doesn't know as much or doesn't have as much on paper experience, but they are at least loyal and good, honest people, you know, that when they give you their 8 hours, they're giving you their best.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be the one that takes the time to try to find those people. And also another thing that's important is that I've learned, you know, is that you have to be able to let people go, you know, regardless of how much you like them. If they're not doing the job for you.
I think there's a famous quote from some company, it may be like Sam Adams or something like that. I kind of forget, but the hiring practices is hire slowly and fire fast. And I don't know if you fully agree with that. The hire slowly is a good idea, you know, really take the time to look at it. But a lot of people out there say to just fire the first sign of anything wrong. And I don't fully agree with that, but you should not waste too much time on a terrible employee.
The CEO of IBM was asked on TV one time in an interview. It was one of their senior vice presidents or something like that had made a mistake that, and I think this was back in the 60s, and it cost the company like $500,000, which mm-hmm. back in the 60s, you know, would have been quite a bit more, mm-hmm. you know, like losing $10 million or something today. And he was asked point blank, I guess this was somewhat public, he was asked point blank, he says, well, what are you going to do with that? Are you going to fire him? And the CEO said, no, I just spent $500,000 training him.
Yeah, that's a good one. I grew up working in Western Kansas, you know, in the oil field. And there's a pumping company. They sell the pumps that go down at the bottom of the well. That's what actually pumps the oil up. And they repair and make new ones, because you have to replace those about every, well, it depends on what kind of well it is and who's running it, to be honest with you, but sometimes you have to replace them quite often. And whenever he hires somebody, he told me once that he has in his budget that they're gonna fuck one of them up, they're gonna just break something, they're gonna ruin a pump. So he has in his budget when he hires a new employee on his deal the cost of an entire pump, which is about, you know, $5,000 or $10,000 or something like that. He just writes that off, that they're gonna break one. and that's because that's the training method, with it, you know? Yeah. At some point they're gonna mess one up and that's it. And if they do two, then they gotta go. But one you can break, and as long as you don't do another one, you're good.
Now, did he communicate that to the new hire?
No. Okay. Nope, that was just in his wheelhouse. Right, he was just telling me about that at some meal. I remember it was a funny story. But yeah, so having that kind of room for error is important. So I'll talk a little bit about our hiring practice. I don't know if this is the best hiring practice that there is, but for our small business, it works. And we've seemed to have the last four hires we've done have been pretty good. So I have an attorney that works for me. She was my first full-time employee, and she is kind of a friend. I could never fire her, but she does a great job for me. But she's a little bit different than me. I'm a little optimistic. I'm kind of, you know, everybody deserves a chance, and she's real no-nonsense. So our kind of method is we get the resumes in on Indeed or wherever. I go through the resumes, and I kick out resumes that are terrible, but I get good resumes, and I find about 10 that I like, and then I hand them off to her, and then she whittles that down to about four okay ones by her estimate, and then we usually interview those people. And we've done pretty good so far, but...
Well, I've got to say that it seems to be working out for us, too, because you've helped us to adopt that practice, and it's been good, because I'm like you. I'm very optimistic. I'm very much like the first warm body that shows interest in me mm-hmm. and seems like a positive person.
Yeah.
Come on, let's go.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things is that I think everybody who has half a brain who's interviewing for a job is going to try to put their best foot forward. And they're going to, if nothing else, they'll feign enthusiasm for whatever you're doing.
Yeah.
And if you're not the kind of person that is willing to fire fast or fire, you know, to be a little bit harsher when needed, then you're going to find out that you're going to keep those type of people a lot longer than you should. And it'll make you frustrated, and it makes them frustrated, you know, 'cause they can sense it. and they're just, you know, continuing on until, you know, the axe eventually falls. And that's not a good situation for anybody. You know, it's much better if you spend the time like you do with your process, mm-hmm. To try, you know, to get the best candidates possible and then weed those out into the, you know, hopefully end up with someone that's going to work well with you. That has proven to be a lot better, you know, and it's a lot less frustration. It's a lot less, anxiety.
Yeah. Interviews are kind of an important aspect where you can kind of ask them about their resume, make sure that things seem to line up. You can also do some light background checks, especially with today's, you know, social media and stuff. We typically do a background check where we can look on like available court documents, and then you can also look through their social medias and stuff like that too.
I also would say that it's also important to learn the relevant laws.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that, you know, I've been educated on by you, because there are certain things that you can ask and certain things that you can't ask.
Can't ask their age, man.
Yeah.
I know you tried to do that every time.
Yeah, it's not, for me, it was always a point of just, you know, friendliness, yeah, more or less. But I didn't know that. I didn't know you couldn't ask people their age.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important, right? It's important to be up to speed on all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Because another thing that you don't want to happen is you don't want to find yourself in some sort of a lawsuit.
Yeah.
One of my friends owns several dispensaries around town.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how the suit's going, but he got sued by an employee who said she felt uncomfortable because somebody made a racial joke or something in one of the stores.
Yeah.
And I guess instead of taking that up to, you know, the higher chain, or, you know, I don't know what his HR said. I don't know how his HR thing goes in his organization, but from what I understand, he was more or less blindsided by this.
HR is almost non-existent in most of the companies that I've dealt with, and I always encourage them to get some type of standard operating procedures or employee manual or something like that to show how those things are going to go.
What do you think about companies? I've seen like a few outfits out there that offer basically virtual HR.
Yes, and some of them are great. A lot of them really focus more on benefits and things that they can give their employees. You know, they'll manage like healthcare and stuff like that. But the most important aspect of the HR thing for you as the employer, besides keeping your employees happy, is to make sure you're covering your ass and make sure you've got all those documents in place, and that if there's a claim of sexual harassment or uncomfortable in the workspace, that you have a good standard operating procedure to handle that. So yeah, those, I don't have any real great recommendations off the top of my head. I like Paychecks and Paycom and those kind of things. If you have a payroll service, typically have those. But we should probably find and recommend a good online service. You also have to follow, you know, both the federal law, and then every state's a little different. So that's where those services can come in handy, because they really know what every state
has. And that'll be something that people can find on our website.
Yeah, I think we'll try to put some recommendations up, particularly in the future. But, you know, you can just Google and find one that you're comfortable with that has good reviews. And again, it also depends on how you do your payroll. But I go through the top line kind of employee and payroll practices during one of our steps, which is in the prepare phase, where we talk about payroll and employees. And it's got all that information in there.
So, you know, just for the audience out there, you know, just so you know, when this podcast blows up, we will be accepting bids from all those companies that want to pay us a lot of money.
Yeah,
and then we will say nice things about you.
There you go.
No, we will always give fair reviews of anything that we do if we decide to do that. But the main thing for us is we want to make sure that our listeners and the people who follow us, they have really good access to truly good information.
Yeah.
So look on our website. We will give you as much information as we can to help you in that area.
Yeah.
But it is extremely important.
A lot of that too will just be kind of links. And we do have a page on our website, I believe, that has every state and the various, like, you know, payroll and legal resources. So unfortunately, there'll be a little bit of digging depending on what state you're in. But a lot of the practices are pretty the same, you know, and it's mostly just around don't be a dick and make sure you, you know, make sure you have good handle your employees well.
Don't
you know?
Be a dick. Don't show your dick.
Yeah, don't do anything with a dick. Yeah. There you go.
Remember what happened to Louis C.K. about that, right?
Man, poor. That's a terrible situation. So, well, yeah. Anything else about employees that we missed, you think? I mean, we kind of just talked about this from an employer standpoint and like what it's like to hire people. There is so much about being an employee that's different, but probably.
Well, I would say I think most people have probably worked for someone else at some point, you know, so very few people just jump right into entrepreneurship.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that think of all the things as an employee that bothered you. You know, think of all the things, you know, that like people will say, well, you know, my boss was a jerk or they didn't, you know, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing and all that. And just endeavor to be better, you know, than that, because you want to, it goes back to the old adage of treat people like you want to be treated, right? So if you were an employee and you were in jobs that didn't treat you very well, then don't do that.
Yeah, you really want to figure out how to be a good boss. Everybody's a little different, but to be a good boss, but it's always very clear when you're a bad boss. I think a lot of times people will say, you know, be a leader rather than a boss. I was just reading on Reddit this morning that some guy posted on like small business or something that his boss took them outside in the parking lot to show off his new Cybertruck. And then mentioned that payroll was going to be late because he couldn't afford it.
That's like
his back-to-back moves.
Oh, my gosh. There's a joke that goes around where the boss shows up in a brand new car, you know, really nice, newest, latest model, whatever. And the employee is admiring and he says, hey, boss, that's a really nice car. And the boss says to the employee, you know, if you work really hard this year, then I can get another one next year.
Yeah, I've heard that before. Yeah, that's a good point to bring up, though, about the employer and employee relationship, because, you know, you as the employer are incentivized to get the maximum amount of effort out of your employee for the least amount of money. And the employee is trying to get the most money out of you for the least amount of effort. And that's typically where those incentives kind of bang heads.
Right, and I think that is a topic worthy of discussion at another time in more depth, you know, about the attitudes of both sides, you know, and what can happen. Well, you know, it's like there are times, you know, when you pay people by the hour and then you just watch them screwing off, you know, and it's like it's just like watching money just kind of float off into the river.
Yeah, well, it's I think it's a real common study they did where like 80% of the work in a given week is done between Tuesday afternoon and Thursday morning. And then basically the first day and a half and the last day and a half of the week is just nothing.
So, you know, part of that would be like the story you just told earlier about the guy that builds in breaking a pump.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe that's part of building it in. Germany, for example, they do work weeks that are 38 and a half hours. So they basically work like a half a day on Fridays.
Yeah.
Well,
I know some people like to do the 4-10s. So they do 4 10-hour work days.
Right. And that's become popular, you know, more flex work, stuff like that. I will often tell people, you know, if there's something that they can do that doesn't require them to be here, then fine, you know, stay home and do it as long as it gets done.
I struggle with that remote work because every time somebody's at home working, that it seems like it's always an excuse on it getting late or not being done. But I know a lot of people do successfully work from home, and I know a lot of employees like working from home.
Well, especially since COVID, you know, it's become a much bigger thing.
Yeah.
But I think you just have to find that balance, because it's possible to find the balance. You know?
Oh, for sure.
It's realizing that the way that we were brought up, or the way that I came up, which was, you know, you're going to be at work at 9 o'clock, you're going to get off at 5. If you start at 7, you're going to get off at 3 or whatever. You know, you got to put in those solid 8 hours, rigidly,
Yeah, I've found a lot of success in that kind of work method where if you just, you know, you have the results and what you need done, and it doesn't matter when they do it. So they have a little bit more flexibility in their time. But some of the older employees that work for me, they're here at 8 o'clock on the dot, and they work until 5, and that's when they go home, and that's just what they like doing.
Sure. And yeah. I think that as an employer, wherever possible, that you can accommodate both of those types.
Yeah, be flexible.
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, that's all I have for employees. Any other thoughts? I'm sure we have lots more to talk about, but that's enough for this one, I think.
Well, you know, I'm not like a lot of employers. You know, I see a lot of these guys out there that are basically like, nobody wants to work and this and that. And I think that it's just a matter of not putting everybody in the same box, you know, looking at people as individuals and being willing to take the time to find the right match.
Yeah. Fair enough.
This episode is sponsored by JB Cases. JB Cases is a pool cue case company specializing in custom cases. They have been in business since 2007, and their motto is true protection, true durability, true comfort, and true custom. Visit them at jbcases.com.
Well, in our kind of last segment of this, we're going to talk about avoiding burnout. And I think we're going to talk about this quite a bit. Self-care and mental health and avoiding burnout are really key for when you're starting your business. I don't care what business you're starting, you're going to work really hard. You're going to work long hours, and you're not going to get paid as much as you think you should be, and especially when you're starting out. You know, now I've kind of reached a point where I can delegate a little more. So instead of working 60-hour weeks, I'm only working about 45. You know, during tax season, I still work 100-hour weeks. But for me, I like to, you know, play golf. I play games with my buddies, and I have a pretty comprehensive and robust self-care plan. We ask all of our interview people what their self-care plan is. And vacations are a good part of that. We were just talking about your vacation at the beginning of this. So how are you doing on your burnout level, you think, right now?
Well, I certainly feel a lot. I feel refreshed. And even though that the trip was a lot of traveling, I did most of the driving. I didn't have to, by the way, but I did most of the driving. And a lot of that driving, it allowed me to catch up on things like podcasts that I had been wanting to listen to. It allowed me to think. And one of those podcasts that I listened to, you know, part of it was basically saying that, people are sometimes accused of being lazy when they take time to daydream, you know, but that's when your mind is actually working to solve, you know, to think about issues and you're letting your subconscious kind of run wild.
Yeah.
And it allows you a separation from that immediacy of what has to be done right now so that you can think about these strategies. You can think about the future. You can think about, you know, how you want to market a new thing or whatever. Or you can think about, you know, things that you can just improve in your business, you know, or improve as a person. So I think that's important to have that time to yourself, you know, even if it's a little bit each day. For example, like for me, I started taking walks, you know, just to kind of improve my health. But I found that 30 minutes, 45 minutes in the morning helps me to think.
Yeah.
You know, it helps me to kind of get a handle on the day and think about where I want to go. So yeah, I think that's one way to do it is not only storing up all your frustration until you can go on a vacation, but looking for the ways where you can have some relaxation even during the workday or just prior to, so you can let your mind wander, you know, and really just rediscover a lot of the fun of why you got into the business in the first place.
And you need to find kind of what works for you specifically. Mm-hmm. So like you're saying, you know, what works for you is walks and taking little breaks and stuff. I'm kind of, especially during tax season, I'm one of those kind of guys who I'll just work until I start to feel burnt out. And then whenever that day is that I feel burnt out, I just take off. So I'll probably work, you know, 14, 15 days in a row, and then I'll just take a random Tuesday off. I'll go play golf or just relax at home and watch some movies and kind of just ease my burnout. And that works pretty well for me, especially with my business and being able to kind of be flexible in my schedule. You know, if you have a more rigid schedule or you have to be there, making sure you're taking those weekends or those time off is really important. And I also think it's important to build into your budget, especially your personal budget when you're doing the financials for your company, to have some money set aside to do fun things. You know, you don't have to take an extravagant vacation, but a weekend, you know, to the next town over, grab a hotel room for a night and have a nice steak dinner. That's important stuff.
Oh yeah, we've done that as well. You know, we've taken not even going out of town. You know, we've just gone to a nice hotel or something, mm-hmm. had a couple days.
Yeah.
Stuff like that really works.
It does. That's what works for me, you know, those little trips and just a day off randomly once in a while. But there's a lot of great ways to do it.
My boss, and I haven't had a lot of them, you know, since I started my business back in, you know, 91. But the aforementioned time when I sold my first company and then I was in between, and so I took on a, you know, where I said me and my boss were butting heads as entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
He would very often do fun things. Like he would say, okay, everybody, we're closing down the office for an hour and let's go out for ice cream.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah, you know? Super fun.
And it was just totally random, but it was cool, you know, because it would just break up the day and kind of give everybody a little reset that we would all just think about it and talk about it for another couple of days after that, you know, and feel better.
Yeah. I think it's also important to mention that when you're trying to do these things to avoid burnout, you should really focus on healthy things to do. I know when I first started my business, my kind of relief would be to go out to the bars and have a few beers and shoot pool and probably stay up way too late and stuff like that. And I really feel like it was an overall negative impact. Like that night I was having fun, but then the next morning I was dragging, it added more work for me. And I feel like having healthy outlets is a key thing to say.
Well, and I will say, you know, I'm not a big drinker, but there have been times when I've been frustrated with my business or my own performance in my business. And I've allowed myself to get a little bit smashed once in a while, you know, and honestly, it's more escapism than it is self-care.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with it every once in a while, but I just, if you're using that, I used that for many years as kind of my main source of having fun and relaxing and trying to decompress, and it just doesn't do what you want it to do. It would have been much better had I just gone to sleep early and woke up and played golf the next morning. I would have felt much better. So.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that we can learn. We can also learn best practices mm-hmm. from, you know, taking advantage of all of the things that humans have discovered about being a human is important.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not to say, you know, you shouldn't sit around and try to acquire knowledge just so you can have knowledge. You should try to acquire knowledge that you can use, mm-hmm. that you will use. There's a lot of people that do that, me included. You know, I'll constantly look at things that look like they would be healthier for me. They would be fun to do. And then I just never do them.
Yeah.
You know, so that can be a source of frustration and burnout too, you know, because it leaves you wishing that you would get up off the couch and go do those things.
Yeah.
So I would say to people as part of avoiding burnout, you know, actually take that step. If you find things that you think would be helpful to you or healthier, do it.
Yep.
You know, it's very important, because once you start doing something like that, not only can you decompress, but you're also enjoying the learning of a new thing.
Fair enough. Well, any other final thoughts for this episode?
I would say that it's probably not a good idea to go on, like, as far as your business goes. Don't go on any drug-fueled binges and promise the world things.
Oh, okay.
You know, as a way of avoiding burnout or any other thing.
I feel like avoiding drug-fueled binges just in general is probably good.
Yeah, it's probably
it had nothing to do with whether you're owning a business or not. But.
It probably is, but I think that as a business owner,
yeah.
probably just staying away from that practice altogether will help you to
be successful,
to maintain a healthy position, and that's not a good way to cope with pressure and burnout.
Right. Fair enough. Well, catch us on turtlesmith.com, and we'll see you next week, man.
All right. That wasn't autobiographical, by the way. Autobiographical.
Fair enough.
Not entirely. All right. You guys take care.